Organization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. I think today we are recording episode 201. Now, when I record these episodes, not all of them gets published, but near all of them gets published. We had a bit of an issue last couple of weeks with an episode that I recorded, and we had a bit of an audio issue, so we wasn't able to make it online, and we're working to fix that with Riversides. Beside that, I want to welcome you to another conversation today. I'm really interested in this kind of conversation. I've been looking forward to speak to my guest today since we booked the podcast. My guest today has built over a dozen businesses before he found the one that clicked. Today, he runs Pearl Lemon Group, 132 people across six continents. His team generate more than 1,000 sales, inbound sales leads, which are near and dear to my heart. As everybody knows, I'm a fractional CRO on the side as well. That's part of my day job. And I'm always interested in lead generation. So I'm very, very happy that we're having this conversation today. I'd love to dig into that. And also, he uses things like Google, ChatGPT, and other large language models. Now he's deep in what he calls vibe coding. And also I do vibe coding, so we've got something in common there.
Yeah.
And shipping software tools monthly through his new venture, Lem Studio. And asking the question every sales leader I know he's asking and wrestling with, where does AI actually come in to replace a human in the sales process? At what stage do we inject human AI in the sales process, or the reverse that? Or at what point do we inject a human in the sales process? We may be wanting at some point to ask the question in reverse. But today, Deepak Shukla, he's joining me on this journey of 1 hour recording. I really appreciate you being with me, and welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat. It's an honor to meet you. It's an honor to have you as a guest.
Well, Robin, thank you for the wonderful introduction. I'm excited to talk to you today about all of the above. As you said, sales qualified leads, how AI is coming in, and if it's helping or harming or some combination of both, and everything else besides. So really lovely to be here.
So as we say on this channel, Deepak, is it okay with you if I call you Deepak? Is that okay?
Okay.
If you don't mind, as we say on this channel, everybody's got a story. Now, I read a lot about you. I'm familiar with your story a little bit. But for the audience, if you don't mind, what is your story?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Deepak Shukla. I run the Pearl Lemon Group. We've been around for 8 years. I got into the world of deciding I wanted to build originally a marketing company maybe 10 years ago. And then 2 years later, that became Pearl Lemon. And then maybe a couple of years later, that spawned into the Pearl Lemon Group. I started that when I was 30. I spent my post-university, I was an English literature major, starting out as a consultant at Deloitte. I kind of dropped out when I understood that I wasn't quite fit to have a corporate career. And then I spent much of my 20s, I would say, wandering and exploring, which was a combination of business ventures slash attempts, whether it was raising a little bit of money, I think it was £75,000 at that time, to run a startup, which I then proceeded to use, in fact, to go and party in Lisbon, which was, part of a potted history. And I got to 30, realized I wanted to do something more settled with my life, because the 20s were marathons, ultra marathons, Muay Thai, applying to the special forces, scraping by through starting a business and then switching once I've made a little bit of money. And when I turned 30, I came back to the UK, because I spent most of that time going back and forth in and out of the UK. Then I got settled. I'm actually now settled in Italy. So the new home is Italy, as it has been for the last couple of years. And I think that the primary skill that traverses that entire narrative is not necessarily marketing, but effective communication, because actually that's what marketing really is, effective communication. So I think that that's been really the skill that has stuck with me, that I had some predisposition I've leaned into. And of course, we can go on to talk about that. But that's, I guess, a little bit of the story.
Now, so which part of Italy you're in?
So I'm the nearest airport is Turin. So the province is called Biella. So Turin, for those of you who don't know, is home of maybe Juventus Football Club. And if you don't know Turin, then it's close-ish to Milan. So people would have heard of Milan, so northern Italy.
Did Turin host the Olympics not too long ago?
Olympics. Yeah.
The Winter Olympics was in Turin as well, right?
Yeah. Correct. It was one.
And do you like Italy better than England, or what's the story then?
Yeah, sure. My wife's Italian, born and raised. She lives about 15 minutes from where we now have our home. And we met when she was visiting London maybe 15 years ago now. at that point, there was no part of my journey where I thought I'd end up in Italy. But, you know, hey, you meet an Italian woman, you spend 10, 12 years in the UK. We tried Spain, we tried Italy, we came back and forth. We got married a couple of years back. And then post-COVID and post-Brexit made leaving the UK a lot easier. Let's say that when the face of London and the UK changed quite a bit. And then it felt like, okay.
I can appreciate that. Yeah, no, I understand that completely. Yeah. Now, let's get into a little bit about your corporate history and your business journey in general. You launched more than 10 businesses before Pearl Lemon. At what point does a serial entrepreneur stop calling it persistence and start wondering if they are just wired wrong?
It's a really great point. Definitely in terms of the wiring or walking an uncommon path, I think that entrepreneurship is definitely, from what I've seen, for the people that take it to a place of moving out of your family home, having an income that can support more than one people, whether that's through payroll or through family. I think that that's when you understand that you have an aptitude to take continuous risk and then get to a place where you can build safety. So for me, I think that when I was younger, I saw it probably, or the world saw it, i.e. my family, as more recklessness. And it manifested in, okay, I want to go and travel. Okay, I'm going to quit my job at Deloitte. Okay, I'm going to not take up this internship offer that I've got the Financial Times. Okay, I'm going to go and do this. Okay, I'm going to study English literature and I'm not going to study business or economics or whatever it might be. So you kind of make these decisions that seem scattered. I want to be a rapper, mum. And they're like, what? It's 2008, you're Indian and you want to be a rapper and all of that sounds wonderful, but how's that going to pay the bills? You know, all of these, with enough persistence or recklessness, you realize that, you know what, this is who I am. And I think when you embrace it or weaponize the most latent or vibrant parts of your personality and lean into it, I think then you can live more abundantly. I do think that there's a part of nature to taking calculated risk. And when you see it's part of your nature, I feel that it's just something that's worth nurturing and turning it from passion into profit. So I think that, you know, there's definitely, you know, a predisposition that all of us have. Similarly, the sports is the analogy I like to make. Some people were born to lift heavy and some people were born to run. One can do the other, but nature will very quickly tell you which one suits the way that you've been made.
Absolutely, 100%. And you know, to the audience, when Deepak talks about a rap song, so he actually ran a rap group at 18, and it's called The Dark Side Soldiers, recorded 150 plus songs, performed at a warm-up act for UK regime artists, grim artists, sorry. And so I want to make sure I put that out there because you passed this through casually, but it was a significant part of your life at some point.
Yeah, wow. Okay, yeah, it was. I got serious about it.
Sorry, I did the research there, Deepak. I'm sorry about that.
You did. Most people don't really. Wow. This is so off air, everybody. Robin was asking me if I'd been on several podcasts recently. I have. Robin is the only person who has discovered that about me. So I'm super impressed. Yeah, so Robin, that was my first entrepreneurial journey without realizing that it was an entrepreneurial journey. Got passionate about it when I was 14, found it to be a struggle to even communicate the idea that I wanted to be such a thing at 14, 15. And it continued as being something that was relatively serious all the way up, I think, until about 22, because my first business, Dark Side Soldiers were the first music group, but my first business was Deep Impact Recordings, which was a recording studio that I set up to originally produce my own music. And then I discovered that I enjoyed the business of music far more than I enjoyed the production of music. And that was where I began awakened or became enlightened to, oh, so you can build your own business. This is interesting. So yeah, no, you're quite right. It was a significant part of my life, and those songs still exist on SoundCloud in a private account. So yeah, it's still alive with some embers.
And the only reason I mention that is because we're all human and we all go through a journey in life, and our interests, our needs, our wants, what we like and what we dislike changes over time. But we're all born with a set of skills and set of things that we are born with that we probably don't crystallize, and life crystallizes it over time, and it just brings it up to the surface. For instance, I don't know how many of our audience knows that I was born and raised when I was a young kid in Beirut, Lebanon. I immigrated during the Civil War. I left the country But within, when I was a kid, at the age of 14, I won the first time and the first place in the country a watercoloring draw. Like I was selected as a young artist in the country. I was given a prize by the president of the country at the time.
Wow.
I mean, and then I drifted away from all this artistic stuff, and I ended up in university studying computer science. Now, we all go through all these things, and life takes us the way life takes us. And we're meldable human being that we can flex with life, and we can adjust and adapt and survive. So you went from Deepak, from rap music to tutoring to haircuts to digital marketing. Is there a thread connecting all of this? And does it look like a mess from the outside, but it's an organized chaos on the inside? Or I'm trying to get the, what is the common connection there?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, I mean, of course, wherever I go, there I am. I do think that's a wonderful expression, often applied to therapy, but naturally, no doubt, I am, of course, the common thread within all of those, the narrative. There was, and I would probably less so now because I've built in some guardrails, but definitely there was a huge amount of impulsivity as related to ideas I had and then seeing how quickly I could execute it and turn it into something. So my decision to drop out at Deloitte was followed by the desire to build a recording, to become a musician, to become a rapper. And then I understood that, well, I need to have a recording studio. I'm not going to have an income to begin with. I need to make an income. So then I took to books to understand how to build a studio. Then I built a studio. That there were several years doing that and lots of adventures. I then wound that studio down because I had my own relationship problems and self-esteem, and I got into some bad relationships. And actually, practically, I lost my MacBook that had no music backed up to the cloud back in 2006, 2007. I don't remember when it was, but I left it on a bus when I went out drinking one evening. And that was the ceremonial death of that business. And then I thought, okay, like I'm done. That's it. I've lost all of the individual WAV files for my musicians. I'd already given them the production, but I lost the backups, I guess, from their perspective. Then I thought, what can I do? You studied English. Why don't you teach English? And then I went and signed up with a tutoring agency. And then I thought, hang on, they're paying, the client is paying them £36 an hour. They're paying me 18. And I thought, this is quite a good business. It can't be that hard. Got onto, I think it was Weebly at the time, set up my Gobsmackers website, put together, I thought, oh, I should record a nice tutorial video. It still exists on YouTube if anyone wants to watch it. Record it. Hey guys, welcome to Gobsmackers. My name's Deepak Shukla and I'm Started this whole tutoring journey. And then I packed that up when I realized that running a tutoring agency wasn't what I wanted to do. Left the country, turned off my mobile phone that was attached to the business because there was a work phone. And I just said, I've got maybe 25,000 pounds in the bank. That's enough for me to bootstrap and travel. I traveled and then I got into the world of, because I'd started on Weebly, maybe moved to Moonfruit, and then I discovered this thing called WordPress. And I was like, oh, you can build kind of websites. And I had a barber that I used to go, and that was still when I was in my musician days. So I'd get like a skin fade and then a line and then a trim. And I was like, oh, maybe I could start like a haircut business called Haircut Heroes. And this was the kind of running theme of most of my a lot of impulsivity, a lot of turbulence, and making everything make sense in the time, but no staying power.
You know, moving on to the Pearl Lemon Group, and you know, that segment is also very interesting as you found your way to build this organization. Your first $250,000 came from cold email at an Upwork pitches. That surprised me. Upwork? People use Upwork still, I guess. Then you became the person who helps others generate inbound leads. What does it feel like to have crossed that line yourself?
I think that when I started on my journey of building the new business side of the agency, I remember with Upwork, well, the feeling actually, to answer your question directly, it felt surreal to be able to generate work remotely at that time because I'd never really done it in that way before. In that my first business, the recording studio was built initially based upon network, and then network, a spiraling of the network, which is what I was accustomed to. Gobsmackers, the tutoring business, I put ads up on Gumtree, which is a classified ads website. And then I do flyering in car parks. I used Parkopedia, which was at that time the parking version of Wikipedia, and you could get all of the car parks within your area. But like, ooh, lots of cars in this car park, and I'd get a bus to different car parks to drop flyers. So then I felt, right, I want to do stuff remotely. And that was, it was common, but it was not that common to do work entirely remotely, because I partnered with a friend of mine in London, and he had a network-based business, and we thought his network would bring me business, and his network brought me no business. And then I thought, well, I need to do something. So whilst I'm sat in the office, because I was working out of his office, he had a software development business, and I thought, well, let me just try and register on one of these freelancing platforms. And that was Upwork.
Mm-hmm.
I got a job relatively quickly, and I was pleasantly surprised. And it was a whole series of positive reinforcement loops. And then I have always, at that stage, I would spend my evenings downloading Udemy courses, and I'd watch a Udemy course on this or a Udemy course on that. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's cool. Let me try that. Much like how I figured out Weebly or Moonfruit or WordPress, I built our first website. It was per traffic then. And there was the continuous desire to acquire new skills that were all circling around marketing, because I'd always found it fascinating and interesting. And naturally, once I then tried cold email, I kind of half figured out how to generate leads from cold email. It then became apparent to me that lead generation was something, in the end, that every company was kind of after.
100%.
Above and beyond copywriting or social media scheduling or broadbrush digital strategy, there wasn't a company that I really met that didn't want more leads.
I mean, in any company nowadays, you ask them, big or small or medium sized companies, you know, if you ask them the question, do you like more revenue? And if the answer is no, I mean, that somebody's crazy out there. But the answer typically is yes, I would like more revenue. Now, there are some companies out there, and you probably know that already, is that they qualify that revenue and they start sifting through which type of revenue they want. And that's normal and that's natural. No big deal. I just want to make sure that the audience get that correctly. So Pearl Lemon Group includes Pearl Lemon SEO. So you have an SEO service. Pearl Lemon Leads. So you have a Pearl Lemon Leads generation. And Pearl Lemon PR and Pearl Lemon Web. Pearl Lemon Accountants, Pearl Lemon Properties. I want to ask you about that one. And more. And the group itself generates close to or over 7-figure annual revenue.
Yeah.
So did I miss anything in there?
No, you didn't. The only things to add would be Pearl Lemon Accountants and Pearl Lemon Catering. The model, to help people understand, because of course I sound awfully disorganized, is my primary role within all of those businesses is we have a central marketing hub that generates sales qualified leads. And then we go niche by niche, because there's many other niches that just haven't worked for us very well. But then we identify niches where we introduce a breakthrough point. So the breakthrough point that I typically find is useful is 20 sales qualified leads a month, which actually means you need to generate probably that are budget ready, budget fit, and that are happy to receive a proposal, which typically means you need maybe 50 to 60 inquiries, because not everyone's going to fit the criteria. So let's assume you need 60 inquiries a month to get the 20 sales qualified leads, to get 3 to 5 deals. That then upfront revenue, because then the model is always collect cash upfront, can then pay for building out a delivery team or building out a contracting team or building a proposition that's palatable enough to take on someone who's a service delivery expert, who's maybe a smaller company and or looking to start up their own business and doesn't want to do any of the new business part of it and wants to focus on having great prospects to sell and to deliver to. And that's how all of these businesses resolve. So my accountant, we have a chartered accountant as a partner. The catering, I have a catering delivery partner. We're business partners. Same thing with property investment. And that's kind of the model. And I have lots of examples of where it didn't work because we didn't reach the threshold and I wasn't able to really build anything meaningful. So then I just sunset the website.
And if you'd like to introduce a fractional CRO model, I'm here to support you.
Absolutely.
Now, 1,000 inbound SQL for the audience, let's say sales qualified leads a month, a number most sales leaders, like I think for me, if I'm hearing 1,000 inbound SQL, I'm just jumping from joy here. Most sales leader would probably think, oh, this is impossible. From a budget perspective, you must have a massive team. If you don't mind, just give us an insight to how the machine actually works from your perspective.
Yeah, sure. So the best type of inbound lead are leads that have come via content or demand generation. So that means they're way more qualified than outbound activity. because outbound, you don't know where someone is along their buying journey. If you do anything that's cold outbound, cold call, cold email, LinkedIn, networking, for example. Now, that's just why the mechanism is the mechanism. So we prefer inbound as a mechanism because it means typically if you can generate demand, you have a smaller need for pipeline and associated sales infrastructure. There's just a deferred payoff because you need to do a lot of upfront work. So the nature of that upfront work can often be offshore. So if we're talking SEO and we're talking content, you can offshore that to developing economies. The thing that if you make a commitment to a developing economy is that you still need one or two really good strategic people to lead teams. Often you can have people that do the work, but the question is, what is the right work to do? And can they be trained up to a competent standard? So that's what our team will be between India, Pakistan, and South Africa. And then we'll focus on SEO, and it will be SEO across multiple platforms. So that's YouTube, Google, but everything's about demand inbound. So that would be how we'd look at it. And then to the point, for example, if we take your fractional CRO, within the CRO niche, there's going to be multiple subsets where there's different levels of need. So there's CRO, you know, in construction, in manufacturing, in real estate, in just to give you an example of bottom of funnel niches. So what we would tend to do is rather, for example, than having, if it's Robin Ayoub's CRO.com, we believe in the concept of go way, way deeper within your one mechanism that you decide to work upon. So we will typically have five websites as opposed to one, because the goal is to find one keyword that works and occupy positions 1, 2, 3, 4 for the same keyword, as opposed to take 10 bets across 10 different keywords. Now, to get there, you have to figure out which keywords give you an outsized return. But if you build a cost-efficient structure to run those tests, and the only way really to run a cost-efficient structure that I've found is to offshore everything. But then also when you offshore, you don't need senior people offshore. You need one senior person who can train juniors, because often it's not an intellect problem. It's just a directional focus problem and sticking the path problem, because people, much of this work isn't difficult, but it's about discipline and focus direction. And that's where the senior person can lead the junior people. So that's kind of the model that we set up. And over time, that can allow you, we have 130 websites now. And I'll be honest with you, I'll tell you that 70% of them at the moment don't generate any leads. But on any given day, we don't know which 70% will then suddenly pop up and start generating leads. So that's why we aim for diversification, which also gives us insurance against, well, what about Google is reducing its coverage? What about the LLMs coming in? It's like, well, hey, I've got 10 shots at making this work. All I need is really one.
You know, there are so many things I want to unpack in this conversation right now. Maybe 1 hour is not enough for this conversation, especially when it comes to revenue diversification. This is a subject I've talked about all my life. Many companies operate in the 80-20 model, meaning 80% of the revenue comes from the top 20 customers, which creates, in some cases, I'm being generous here, in some cases, 80% of the revenue comes from one customer, which if that customer leaves, now you've got a big issue in terms of survivability, like it becomes very detrimental to your company. And from the customer looking in, if they ask you the question, give me, you know, they need to feel confident that they can do business with somebody. They ask you the question, generally, give me the makeup of your revenue. How your revenue is distributed. And as soon as you present the picture to a customer, sometimes they back out. Why? It's because they feel insecure a little bit about doing business with a company that's 80% of its revenue coming from one customer. They probably don't want to do business with that type of customer, that company. Now, I've noticed something also when I was doing some research on you, and this is very interesting because we're debating this topic right now, and we started earlier a little bit about AI. Now, are you really getting leads from ChatGPT and LLMs in addition to Google? Can you walk us through what is the impact, like lead generation? And also you mentioned, we talked SEOs, but where does geo sit? And for the audience, you probably not heard a lot about geos. I've done a couple of podcasts on geo before, but just to remind you, geo is generative engine optimization. The SEO deals with how you rank on Google. Geo is how you rank inside a large language model, whatever that is, ChatGPT, Claude, etc. So walk us through the lead generation using ChatGPT, if you don't mind, or other model that you like.
So I think that when it comes to search, for me, ChatGPT is a crude form of Google when it comes to the data that they have actual access to, because the data that they pull from in terms of referencing will often come from Google. So they source things that they find on Google, and they can obviously source sites directly, but part of how they source sites directly will be what already ranks well on Google. Because ChatGPT won't go to page 50 of Google to identify a resource. It'll probably scrape the web and find something that's relevant based upon a search. So in terms of our makeup, let's go back a step actually. We probably get about 30 to 40% of our leads from the LLMs. Now, there's a couple of crude ways that you can get results from LLMs. Number one, if you go, riches are in the niches. So the more niche you go, the less competition you have, the more likely you're to get referenced if there's less competition. So then if you look at the space of CRO, you then want to go hyper niche and say, well, what about CROs that work for manufacturing companies that are based in London that are 100 plus in size? People, when they query the LLMs, they'll use, you know, AEO, answer engine optimization. They'll query for very hyper specific questions. And then if you tailor for long tail searches, you're going to really collapse the actual competition. So people typically think too broad, but you've got to think niche. And within a niche, there's going to be lots of sub niches. And if you want to then go for complete coverage, oftentimes you can win because there's just a complete absence of competition. You could, for example, if you say, right, I want to only look at fast growth manufacturing companies that are based in the UK who are looking for their best CROs because they are a particular niche and they want someone who's got an understanding of how manufacturing works, particular to UK laws. I'm spitballing, right? But then if you look at that and then you produce content that speaks to that, so the obvious content would be, who are the best providers for CRO XYZ? If you're one of only two or three reference points, you will appear in the LLMs. So the quick workaround is identify niche terms that are super niche. You could use any keyword research tool, or what applies often much, much better is just the laws of common sense, because the laws of common sense will mean a lot of that data isn't immediately available on a search engine, for example, SEO tool. So our best results come from everything that exists outside of the SEO tools, because we apply the common sense. So then if you're looking at any niche, you then identify, and the ways to quickly build a niche is add industry and add a location modifier, and then even add a type of company. So, you know, fast growth manufacturing. So that's type of company, that's industry, and then location would be London. And then you've got CRO. Already you're competing in a much smaller pool. And then if you can populate enough content on a couple of websites, and the websites can be parasitic SEO. So that's Medium, that's your own LinkedIn profile, that's your website. Within a week or two, you can pop up for that specific term. And what the LLMs are really great at is that people, because of how they search, people are searching such hyper-specific things in a way that you weren't historically doing on Google. People aren't going to type out something that's quite long. So that's where we've seen a lot of inroads. So our best leads come from like weird pages that we build. I say weird pages, but very, very particular pages that we build. And then we get amazing leads because someone wants something so specific. And then they say, oh, you came up in Grok. You guys must be the best guys to do this because you actually have a page for what I was looking for. And in my mind, I'm thinking, buddy, I've never done this stuff because it's so specific, but I reckon I could do it because I've done stuff that's quite similar. And that's where you want to focus when there is a competition of one. So if you're the only competition as well as the only provider, it means therefore logically you're the best provider because I'm the only, so therefore I'm the best. So I think that what happens when people think about what they do strategically, especially if you're in services, people don't think laterally enough about how to niche down their actual service. They want to compete with everybody else. And I was like, you've got to go blue ocean. And within your red ocean, there's actually lots of blue ocean. You just need to delve a little bit deeper. So that's how we strategically think about anything that we do.
Now, I know, thanks for the explanation, Deepak. I really appreciate that. And that makes a lot of sense because we go from limited way of searching on Google to an actually telling the story when we search. And AI gives us that ability to tell a story when we're searching. And that's the specificity that we are going to get better results with. Because one of the main complaints in Google is specifically now with, you know, when you go to search, you got a bunch of ads that pops up at the front and you don't know where your page is hiding 20 page deep in your search, and who's going to take the time to go find it, to be honest. Now, but that brings another point where Google has been, and I'm just saying Google for representation here, but it could be Bing, could be any other search engine. The search engines has been a default for buyer discovery for past 25 years almost, right? And so, but things are changing. But based on your data, what you're seeing from your side, how fast do you think this is changing from being Google or search engines being the go-to versus the LLMs and the models that they're popping up here and there now?
Well, I think that the search engines won't go away. I think that it's definitely not going to be a collapse. I think that people forget about how big a machine the search engines are. And how prevalent they still are. They still occupy, I don't even know what the actual market share is, but I'm sure it's still probably about 85% of search entirely. I
think so. And they're adapting, right? Deepak, they're adapting. They're inserting AI into their work now. So.
Yeah, exactly. So I know, for example, there are people that have entirely, say they use the LLMs, but what they're using is the answers that appear in Google. That's how my parents, for example, use it. They just talk to Google and they see the answer at the top. So I think there's but of course one could say, well, that's a different version of the same thing. I think that it's here still and it's not going anywhere. I think there's so many economies around the world that will still continue to use search. And there's certain things, such as when you're looking for local service providers, ChatGPT isn't local in the same way. When you want to look up a local service provider, I would prefer to actually look up in Google if I want a cafe, restaurant, local lawyer, broker, insurer. That's not something that I necessarily go to ChatGPT for. So I think that there's still spaces. Let's see if obviously that changes. Definitely, it's just that there is, of course, a diffusion of search. And the way to, I think, you know, position yourself against that, which is what we're trying to also do is slowly build out other strands. So the big thing for us that we do now is that we have a growing part of YouTube and video, which is, you know, part of the reason why I'm also doing a lot of podcasts, because we want to build defensibility through diversity of sources that we get found. And that's, you know, part of the reason why I said, okay, let's do a bit of a content run, because this is going to be helpful for the entire journey. And I think the point that sits underneath that is anyone's journey is normally multi-touch if they're a serious buyer. So even if it's not about discoverability, what then does become important when it comes to diversity is it has a lot of conversion attribution. So I know that lead generation or marketing, CROs, in many respects, outside in, it feels commoditized. It's very difficult for anyone to discern the real difference between when I was at Deloitte, PwC, Ernst & Young, KPMG, when my friends were at the banks, you know, Morgan, JPM, Goldman, they're kind of not that different, where if you go inside out, everyone's different. So I think that one of the ways to defend against that is, of course, what you're doing, like long form content. So, you know, I think that the other thing that does help with, where people think that, well, what else can I do? For me, I think that that's a quicker way to differentiate yourself now also. So search happens on multiple platforms. I think you have one and you go deep on one, and then you add conversion elements on other platforms, which is where people, for example, recycle content, because that's a primary rationale behind. I do a lot of my longs on YouTube as an example, and then I chop that up and put it out on Instagram and TikTok to spread, like, surface area marketing, I call it, which is how much can you spread your surface area? And the quick way to do that is produce one bloody good piece of long content and then use that to spread across other platforms. And that's, you know, been a big help for us as well. And that's a big part of why also we'll get companies that think we're $100 million companies that come, and at some point down the line, they're like, oh, we thought you were way bigger. And we're like, great, because that's a perception that
it worked. Good job.
Yeah, exactly. It's pat on the back. So what? So your office isn't in London and in New York, and you don't have like 30 guys in? It's like, nah, my boy's out in Pakistan, but they're doing a bloody good job because you're here and I've got you now. So let's chat. And he's like, oh, fuck it, let's do it.
Wonderful. I love that. What a great story. Now, speaking of podcasts, you recently appeared on a podcast called You Can't Tell What's Real Online Anymore. You remember that podcast?
I do.
Trust and reviews in an AI saturated world. Where is that headed? And who gets hurt first if it goes sideways?
I think there's some industries there's some industries that are going to forever change. I have certain songs that are AI songs that are some of my favorite songs. And I'm like, wow, this is better than the original. There was a jazz blues version. There was a load of them that came out that was 21 Questions by 50 Cent. And my wife would never listen to 21 Questions by 50 Cent, but she loves the jazz version. And we listen to it when we're out, you know, out on the open road driving, and we sing along to it. And it's like, this is nothing like the original. So I think that a lot of people have a nostalgic view of looking at ultimately, you know, nostalgia. Let me rephrase. Nostalgia doesn't exist in the eyes of those who are young enough to have not had any nostalgia to begin with.
So it's a generational thing then.
Yeah. It's like some people see Michael Jackson. Isn't he the guy that was the pedophile? And it's like, oh my God, man, this is how some people. Brad Pitt, oh, he's that really old guy, isn't he? He was in that movie. And it's like, God, he was, you know, growing up, it was like, wow. It's like, for some people, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's that old dude that appears in, you know, FUBAR on Netflix. You're like, oh, God, no, that's my identities transition with time. And why would someone who's 12 years old now, who's growing up in the new world, care what's real? So I think that, yeah, I think that licensing is the next big play. If you're an actor, it's like, be smart, license yourself, go via distribution, be the 30-year-old Brad Pitt forever, and that's how you can build your generational wealth. But I observe myself, and I realize that I don't care how the content is created if I enjoy the content, no matter what the content is. And that
should matter.
Yeah, exactly. And that might scare people, and perhaps so. But I think that we're living in a really interesting transitionary point, and I'm nervous and excited about how the future is going to look. But there's definitely, you know, there's problems, of course, because I don't know what's real on YouTube or not anymore. And it's only going to become normal. And that's how, like, what's real? Is there really a war in Iran? Is, you know, just crazy stuff you begin to think about, like, you know, false reporting or real reporting and all this type of stuff. So it's just.
Now let's talk a little bit about the AI utilization, because we're just talking about it right now in the sales process. My personal perspective on things is that AI is exceptional at research. I love the way AI does research. And there are different engines with different capacity or different engines with different results. Depends on what type of research you're doing. You can get different results from different models. It's also good at sequencing and first touch personalization at scale, like if you're trying to do an outreach. And it's not yet at a point where I can replicate the trust building required in a complex enterprise or government sales, where you can engage in deep dialogue. And that deep dialogue is expected in some of these conversations. So in your world, in your company, which exact part of a human sales workflow or AI has really, you took human and you inserted AI, or are they interchangeable? Today with this particular step, we put AI, tomorrow in the same step. We don't need AI, we'll put a human. How are you using AI in your sales process, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure. So we, in terms of how we use it practically day to day, a couple of examples. Like everybody, all sales calls are recorded. We take the transcription and we put that into GPT that turns it immediately into a proposal. So that proposal comes out as a written form. We'll then, of course, paste it into whether it's a Google Doc, or if it necessitates it being branded, we've got a template that's built in Gamma. There's lots of PDF generators that generate beautiful branded templates. So we'll do it in that way. Then also on email, we have an email reply flow for qualifying MQLs that come in and trying to get them to an SQL point. So that has a series of rules and logic. It's kind of part AI, part deterministic logic, really, because, you know, true AI, when it comes to AIs, it's a lot of rules and frameworks that you'll build in. So a lot of it, of course, depends upon how heavy you can educate the actual AI based around the particulars of your niche or your service. So we will use it to get MQLs to SQLs on email. As you can imagine, live dialogue is where currently is the frontier, I guess, of AI. How does it perform in live engagements? It's probably most people, I don't know actually, because I've not done the research, but my assumption is most people tend to agree it's going to get there relatively quickly, given its current rate of acceleration. So I think that that's going to be interesting. I think that I observe myself, and I already watch a couple of AI avatars on YouTube, and I'm happy to watch them because the knowledge they provide is good. And I don't mind that they're AI avatars because, well, the knowledge is good. I've now got my own AI avatar, and we're experimenting with putting out videos on a channel that's just dedicated, hey, I'm the AI avatar of Deepak Shukla. So I'm going to see how that goes. And we're kind of building that out just as an experiment. So I think that at a proposal level, it's being used. At a MQL to SQL level, it's being used. We are looking, we do use it, I beg your pardon, in some cases for inbound, but it does fall apart sometimes because there's sometimes complex service inquiry. So there's still lots of edge cases where it will fall apart fundamentally. And that's where it becomes problematic. But then, of course, it's weighing the relative merits of, as an example with us, we get calls coming in 24 hours a day, and which ones are spam, which ones are valuable, when is the right call coming in, is your right guy going to be there to take the call? So there's all these variations. It's about analyzing the trade-offs, you know, piss a couple of people off, but win more people net. So which one do you take? Because you're not always going to have the best person that's going to have the response for a sophisticated decision maker who comes on like you, has very specific questions. Say, look, before I commit to a call, or before I get my, this is part of the research. So I think that, but I think it will get there. I think it will get there.
Yeah.
I think
it's not yeah. Yeah. No. I know most salespeople probably listening to this right now, and they're saying, well, okay, will AI replace me? And it's a valid question, I guess, as AI and technology in general, not just AI. AI is the foundational technology, but all the other application that's being developed or technologies being developed around AI, I guess that's where we're going with this. What would you honestly say to a 20-year-old BDR right now watching this or listening to us if they were asking the question, will AI replace me?
I think that the bar for almost all knowledge work has moved up several notches. So I think that basic entry level knowledge is now commoditized. So you just have to be better as an average than you previously were. You only have to look at the stock price of Fiverr, I think, has totally collapsed with the advent of AI, because any sane business owner now doesn't outsource to produce graphics, PDF designs. So similarly, at an entry level in anything that I think is knowledge work, we're going to live in the world of more specialization and more specifics. So that's where I think that the bar is different. So for those people, if you, you know, if you're 20 years old and you love selling and you intend to be a BDR, that's fantastic. If you can figure out what your differential is, there's always going to be a place to for you to sell. Because also a lot of it, as much as people talk about it having total agency with agents, it's not there's always gaps. There's always going to be things that's not considered, or prompts that it's given that aren't comprehensive, or assumptions that it makes that are fundamentally false. And that's your area of ultimately, that's your area of attack or your area of specialization, because you see that all the time. But of course, it's important to be cognizant with what's happening and looking at what that frontier looks like. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's given what's happening, I don't know, honestly, how far things will be in a decade from now, though. I can't tell.
Yeah, no, but technology is evolving, right? So, I mean, everything we say right now has got a very short expiry date to whatever statement we put out there, right? Yeah, exactly. Because whatever we say today could be proven wrong tomorrow. I mean, we're just taking a snapshot from where we are right now. I mean, we don't know how this is going to evolve tomorrow. Yeah. With the kids somewhere, may come up with some sort of an application that removes the entire sales process. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Possible.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just
the wave, I think. And just
the evolution is quite scary.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. I think it is. And I think that, you know, the way that we're positioning ourselves at the moment, if anyone's wondering with what we're trying to do, is, you know, our main source of defensibility was Google. And then, of course, AI's come along and people are saying Google's going to collapse as a platform. So our approach to that is, in the advent of worry, we look at diversity, because we think, well, hey, we can't just be reliant upon one platform. And or can we go deeper? So it relates back to what you said about, you know, revenue diversity. It also relates to marketing diversity. And equally, the other part of it is, if you really go deep and specialize, I still think there's always place for, you know, it doesn't mean that acting's going to die out. It doesn't mean that music's going to die out. You know, there's always someone who comes out and breaks the mold. So I am confident in saying that there is never going to be an end for human ingenuity. It just means that you have to be a lot better than you once previously were. Because, you know, humans have a great competitor from a knowledge work perspective in a way that we didn't before. And you know, you watch some of these videos coming out of China, people say even in the physical world, we're robots, it's going to come not far down the line.
100%. And the other side, the flip side of that is the consumer now have a choice. They can deal with machine if they want to. They can deal with automated processes if they want to. Or if they choose not to, they can just deal with the old-fashioned way. And as you mentioned earlier, we're going through a transitional phase. Yeah. And maybe all the current generation is behaving this way, but maybe the next generation that's going to come after us, it's going to be completely immersed into this. And they will go through the phase of saying, you know, my grandfather or father used to do certain things and I want to do them completely automated, completely different way. Maybe. I don't know. But the one fundamental thing is right now is the shift is massive. We're going through transitional phases. There are some people still sitting in the traditional way of doing things while other people are developing the new frontier, if you will, of, you know, I saw this one the other day. These people are developing these tech and they're putting their apps together. And the guy goes, don't develop the app, sell the shovel, basically, how you build these things versus developing the app. Speaking of apps, now you developing on the coding side, you are shipping like tools, you are shipping software. Tell us a little bit about that. What are these tools and what are these programs or application that you're shipping?
Yeah, sure. So we spoke about Haircut Heroes, actually, and it kind of relates back to that era that before I was doing anything related to marketing, part of what was an overlay with everything was I was trying to build the website and build stuff. So Haircut Heroes was going to be a marketplace where you could find hairdressers based upon a haircut that you wanted, and that would be the model. And then I tried to build something called Studio Bookers, which was going to be a marketplace for musicians meet studios. So there's always been a penchant towards anything related to technology. But in that era, I didn't have, of course, the ability. Well, I didn't have the desire to want to learn to develop. That wasn't my area that I could play in the sand. So for different reasons, things never quite worked out. Of course, vibe coding has come along and now it's prompt-based engineering. So that means that if you've got a relatively good ability to articulate a vision, actually that now in today's era makes you a superior developer. And I think that, of course, there was an inflection when you used the word vibe. I think maybe it would just be called coding in this day and age, because to your point, if we look at the 20-year-old developer, I'd be like, man, don't learn Ruby on Rails or PHP or Java or HTML, whatever the new technologies are. I'd be like, you don't need any of that, because it's clearly just going to be all prompt-based. People talk about, of course, I think Claude Cowork and Claude Code. I'm like, that's going to go away as well, in that it's just going to be prompting. You're not going to need to develop anything. You're just going to be able to really talk to the... And that's kind of what my realization was. And what's great is that I've got 10 years of identifying problems within Pearl Lemon as the business owner based upon the probably $1 million that we spent on subscriptions over the last 10 years. We spent a lot of money for different things, whether it's in the lead gen space, Zoom Info, Apollo, Lusha, Cognizant, whether it's calendars, Calendly, You Can Book Me, HubSpot, CRMs, HubSpot, Pipedrive. And we have grievances for different reasons with all of the tools that we purchase. And I've been AppSumo, if you know, it's a platform where you can buy lifetime deals. I've been one of the longtime buyers on AppSumo pretty much since they came around. So you kind of put this all together and you're like, well, we spend about 100K a year, maybe less now, a lot less now. But let's say we spend 100K a year on subscriptions for different tools. I think I can replace half of these tools myself now. So why don't I spend 30K for the subscription for the platforms, and in building them, replace the tools that we have, but then also use them to develop SaaS tools outright. So that's been the mental model. And that's why it's, I think, a golden age right now for development. And I think that for those who have a really clear sense of what they're trying to develop, especially for those people who are power users. So the rule that we, or the model that we frame, is only build tools that we're really familiar with. So don't build tools for other people in industries you don't have a knowledge of. Only build tools in places that you've already paid for tools, so you understand, like, intuitively how they work. If you build tools, have a way to, so we have people on payroll. So naturally I can make my team bug test tools every single day, which is massive, because you get the level of rigor that I ordinarily wouldn't. So that's kind of been the framework and principle. And we're using lifetime deal platforms as a mechanism to launch them to the wider public, to get more product feedback, to test them. And then we're plugging them into the kind of marketing machine, if you will, using the similar model that I told you before. But this time it's a case of, well, we're cloning tools that already exist. So we know that there's a market for them. And then, of course, the goal is he who can distribute the best wins fundamentally. So that's really also part of the reason why I'm also on podcasts, because I've got a vision in 4 years from now, not this year, not next year, but if I can build all of that content, it'll become a big tailwind. So that's kind of the framework that I've got mentally. And my role within the agency is, what is the one thing that you do quite well, Deepak? As long as you keep getting sales qualified leads and the team does that, any other problems downstream can be solved with cash. So then that will...
Revenue solves all problems, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of the thinking internally, and why now a big focus is on the vibe coding side of it.
No, look, I really appreciate it. Now, my last question is, if you don't mind, as we come close to wrapping up our lovely podcast, I could talk to you for 2 hours, but it's very interesting. And I've got several other areas that I wanted to talk to, but I didn't have a chance to talk to. Maybe we should bring you back on the podcast, and would love to have the conversation. I really did not really ask you about Amsterdam and how you ran ultra marathons. I have not gone into that, but I'm going to ask you about that next time. So
yeah,
for those who are listening right now, and you know, as we wrap our conversation up, what would you like them to take away from this conversation? How can they get a hold of you? What would you like them to do as an action item?
Yeah. So if you want to get in touch with me, the place where I share stuff is my YouTube or my personal website, but it's probably more YouTube. And I think that in today's state of change, the wisdom or the thing that's always helped me more or less land on my feet is that if you can spend a disproportionate amount of time figuring out how to fill up a diary, so with sales qualified leads, that's detached from your personal effort, I think you can build a lot of freedom. And that was an observation that I made a couple of years into my business, when I understood that growing my brand and attaching it to a service trapped me within that service. So I needed to grow my brand separate to a single service. So they would be the kind of two key takeaways, if that's of any help at all.
No, I really appreciate it. And also, I sent you a LinkedIn connection for the audience who are following this channel. If you're interested in talking to or reaching out to Deepak and you can't find him, reach out to me, connected to him by then, and I will do the introduction for you. I don't mind facilitating an introduction, no problem at all. And I want to thank Deepak Shukla for joining me today. I really enjoyed the conversation. So many other areas that I wanted to ask about, but we did not have a chance to. But I'm sure we'll get you in the next time, and I hope you stay in touch with this channel. Please consider it your own. Feel free to come back anytime. There is no cost for this other than having a coffee with me, a virtual coffee with me. If you can tolerate a conversation with Robin, I think you can tolerate anything. I really appreciate your time. I thank the audience for listening in on our podcast channel. If you are coming on YouTube and you're listening to us on YouTube, I really appreciate you seeing us and watching us on YouTube and following the channel. Thank you so much. Any last comments before I leave, before we terminate the recording, Deep?
For all of you is just keep listening to this podcast. I think that, you know, Robin's a fantastic host, and I think that the continuous penchant for lifelong learning is an even greater safety net than anything that we've discussed. And I think that's perhaps a common thread that connects Robin and me on the call today, that we've always just want to learn more so then we can do more.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody. And thanks for listening in again one more time. And I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks so much, and talk to you later. Bye-bye now.